This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, please go to bbcworldservice.com/podcast.
Hello and welcome to the Africa Today podcast from the BBC at 15:30 GMT on Monday, the 9th of July. I'm Nick Erickson. In the pod today, Egypt, is the president in charge or is he at the mercy of the courts and the military? South Sudan at one, and still it seems neighbors make good enemies.
If you want to come to from Khartoum to Juba, you have to go through Khartoum, Cairo, Juba, or Khartoum, Ethiopia, Juba, or Khartoum, Nairobi, Juba. Only three ways.
And professional dance celebrated in Ivory Coast. Happy birthday, South Sudan. The country marks its first anniversary of independence from the north today. And it's been a day of big celebrations across the country. But no one can deny that there are still many unresolved issues in what has turned out to be quite a messy divorce. A failure to agree on splitting oil revenues has led to a closing down of oil production in the south and the closure of the border between the two countries. The issue of citizenship is also very tricky. The BBC's Nyamburu Wambugu has witnessed today's celebrations in Juba.
Today, a lot of people showed up at the John Garang Mausoleum for the one-year anniversary of South Sudan's independence. And there was a lot of celebration, a lot of jubilation. But at the beginning of the day, the program and the announcements indeed say that they were expecting several presidents from the region, including Meles Zenawi of Ethiopia, Mwai Kibaki of Kenya, and Joseph Kabila of the DRC. But ultimately, only one regional leader showed up. That is Yoweri Museveni of Uganda. But despite that, the celebration went on, be it 3 hours later than scheduled.
And you say there was only one regional president who pitched up. I assume the president of South Sudan was there himself, Salva Kiir. What did he have to say?
Most people I have asked what they thought of this speech say that they felt he was trying to turn a new leaf and trying to say that this year marks a new beginning for South Sudan. He said that he was going to deal with the corruption and that indeed he intended to get the money back that has been allegedly siphoned off from the government coffers. But at the same time, he said that he was not going to tolerate tribalism. And of course, he talked about the conflict with the North, saying that he had no problem with the people of Sudan, and also say that he was committed to the talks that are ongoing between the Republic of Sudan and his own government.
So what do ordinary South Sudanese then think about today's celebrations and perhaps reflecting back over 12 months of independence? What have they been saying to you?
It's a mixed bag of opinion, and I spoke to some of them.
Oh, I'm called Amoko Mark. My hopes after 1 year of independence, I first have to say, since we got independence, we were happy after a long struggle of the war and problems that have been in Southern Sudan, of which most of the people never expected that we are going to be in this kind of independence.
That is one of the residents of Juba, Mark Amoko.
And that was the BBC's Nyamburu Wambugu speaking to me from Juba. So, what is life like for the tens of thousands of northerners who still live and work in the south? Yagub Zakaria Yagub is originally from Darfur in the north, but he moved to South Sudan first for university and then to work for his brother's electrical shop. Mary Morgan caught up with him in the capital, Juba, and asked if anything had changed for him and other northern Sudanese living in the south since independence last year.
Up to now, me and others, I think no one of us feel that he is a foreign citizen here. Just as in the past, as we are Sudanese. Just Southern Sudanese and Northern Sudanese are same nation.
Has the way that people treat you changed, or has the way that the authorities treat you changed?
After the independence, just we got our passports, we got all our documents, because we know that this is a country. The authority of the country may ask us one day, if not today, maybe tomorrow, ask us, where is your document, where is your visas?
Yeah. What's your plans now? Do you think you'll stay in South Sudan, or would you want to go home?
My plan now, just I'm living here in South Sudan, and if they want to leave us for whole life, we can live here. Then I can bring my family and I will live here.
Would it be easy to bring your family, though? Is it easy to travel now from Khartoum to Juba or across the border? Or is it more difficult than in the past?
Yeah,
but that is very difficult because of transportation. If you want to come to from Khartoum to Juba, you have to go through Khartoum, Cairo, Juba, or Khartoum, Ethiopia, Juba, or Khartoum, Nairobi, Juba. Only three ways. Because there is no direct planes between the countries. I think that from the political problems between the two countries, I paid £3,122. It's $1,000. And you have visa. You have to pay $100 in the airport.
So a North Sudanese coming to South Sudan would need to get a visa and pay for it and spend $1,000 on a flight.
Yeah, they spend because they, you know, there is here in South, there is a work. Anyone can get a work. You have to get money or you have an idea. If you have an idea and money, you can do.
That was Yakub Zakaria Yakub, a Northern Sudanese citizen living in Juba, talking to my BBC colleague Mary Morgan. The big question in Egypt since the announcement by the new president Mohamed Morsi over the weekend that Parliament would reconvene was whether or not this would actually happen. This after the lawmaking body had been dissolved by the country's military council and soldiers surrounded the parliamentary building. The army general said they would defer to a top court to have the final say on the matter. Well, our correspondent John Lyon is in Cairo and he joined me a short while ago.
Well, the Constitutional Court has just said that all its rulings are binding, which is a kind of a truism, really, since all courts surely would always say that around the world. The confusing thing about this is it was not the Constitutional Court that actually ordered the dissolution of Parliament. So they're not actually countermanding this decision by President Morsi to reinstate Parliament. All the Constitutional Court said was that the parliamentary elections were unconstitutional. They didn't draw any conclusions from that. So they've really just kind of stated their position that their rulings are binding and it doesn't actually prevent Parliament from reconvening.
So this is a fight then between the military and the new president, essentially.
It appears to be, on the face of it, it appears to be a confrontation. But on the other hand, it could be actually a kind of face-saving compromise that's allowing everybody to walk away from this crisis. Ever since the Parliament was dissolved by the military, the Muslim Brotherhood have not accepted that decision. They're the largest single party in Parliament, so they have every interest in keeping Parliament in play. And so if Parliament reconvenes, it's quite possible it won't be able to pass any laws anyway, because the Constitutional Court will probably say they are unconstitutional. And the Muslim Brotherhood, in any case, have accepted that they should have new elections after a constitution is agreed, probably later this year. So my hunch is actually this is something of a compromise, spoken or unspoken, whereby the Parliament will reconvene, they will have some sessions, they won't really amount to very much, they won't pass any laws that will actually ever be implemented, and everybody's face will have been saved.
But is it possible, John, to say who is actually calling the shots at the moment?
It's a jostle for power, and obviously, particularly at the moment, President Morsi is trying to show that he's not just a president in name, that he's got some real power. And certainly when he took office, it was easy to argue that most of the real power had been held back by the military. So he's trying to assert himself.
John Lyon in Cairo. Now, it's no secret that Africa is a continent that likes to dance. But is it really something you can make a living from? This weekend, the Ivorian city of Abidjan has been hosting the International Festival of Contemporary Dance and Choreography. And our reporter John James went along.
The festival kicked off with a parade involving most of the festival participants walking through the Kokodi district to the opening ceremony. Then, after the introductory speeches, the audience were presented five-minute extracts of the up-and-coming performances. Ivorian dancer Jenny Mazil was one of the festival's main organisers.
I'm very happy just seeing 50 dancers brought together here with people who love dance. It's a real joy. It's a revival of dance in Ivory Coast, and we need to try and keep the thing going. We can't give up. We need to keep moving forward. We need to push the government and push the politicians.
In between the performances, I chatted with Uche Ona, the artistic director for the Ijodi Dance Company in Lagos, Nigeria. I asked him if it was possible to make a living from dance in Africa.
A few years ago, people thought that, oh, it's not possible. I think now it's coming to look possible, as they say. They pump everything financially into football. But I think today dance is coming to be recognized now.
Does your family respect your choice? I mean, you went to the university, as you say, you're a graduate. And then when you told them, I'm going to be a professional dancer, how did they take that?
Well, at first, families or parents were like, okay, no, don't go there. You know, like back in Nigeria, years back, there's this belief that theatre, dance is basically for dropouts. I had to strive hard to encourage my parents to believe in the arts, to believe in me. I'm here today in Cote d'Ivoire. This would be like my 20 countries, Africa, so far that I've been performing. And then I can't count how many European countries I've gone to trying to perform. So today, my parents believe in me, believe in the arts, and say that we can make it in the arts.
But where does the money come from? On the one hand, in Ivory Coast, there's almost no government funding for dance. On the other hand, Ivorians have started expecting cultural events to be free. Frizo Marika is the director for the Goethe Institute, which supported the festival.
The idea was to provide a platform for professional dancers and to give them the chance to produce themselves, show their knowledge to the public, which unfortunately for the moment is still a problem in Abidjan.
Why is it like that here with regards to dance? Everyone here loves playing football, and the professional footballers are the stars. Everyone here loves dancing, but the professional dancers aren't well known, they aren't seen, they don't have a place in society.
I mean, it's certainly difficult to explain, and there's certainly no one reason for it. Nevertheless, there seems to be an idea that if there is some cultural event, it has to be for free, and an idea that it has to be sponsored by the state.
Tourism is seen as one solution to help finance dance groups and keep them in the country. But for the moment, foreign visitors to Ivory Coast tend to be business people rather than cultural tourists. The four-day International Dance Festival here has been one step in reviving the sector, and companies from Togo, Nigeria, Haiti, Senegal, Burkina Faso and France have shared a common stage in front of a public discovering professional dance for the first time in many years.
John James reporting there from Abidjan in Ivory Coast. Well, that's it for today. Thank you for downloading the Africa Today podcast from the BBC, recorded weekdays at 15:30 GMT. Now, you can follow us on Facebook, Twitter and Google+. Our username is BBC Africa and our website is bbcafrica.com. I'm Nick Erickson. Until next time, goodbye.